Okay, great. So I'm delighted that our speaker today is so our speaker today is our own Matthew Madhava Sheryl. So Matt has been with us now for a couple of years as the inaugural Peebles Fellow in the Center for the Universe. Before coming here, Matt got his PhD from Stony Brook, and he was a postdoc at Princeton. So I think that everyone in our group, knows Matt really well, since he's one of our most active members. His work is primarily related to probing fundamental physics using the CMB. So today Matt's going to tell us about some of his recent work on precision cosmology with the next generation of CMB and optical surveys. Matt, whenever you're ready, please go ahead and take it away.
Thanks, Neil. And I'll just note, please feel free to interrupt with questions at any point. As you all know by now, the Zoom format means like as much interactivity as the best. So today I want to share a couple of things that I find really exciting about what we can do with cosmic microwave background and optical galaxy surveys the next 5 to 10 years. And so I primarily work with CMB experiments. The one that I'm working on right now is the Atacama Cosmology Telescope that's pictured here. But then there's also an exciting, upgrade, a big new telescope called the Simons Observatory that'll be coming up that Perimeter is a part of. What I really want to share today is just the fact that there's this idea of using the cosmic microwave background, not just as a snapshot of the fluctuations that you're used to having learned from things like the Planck satellite experiment, but as a backlight. And using this backlight, we can learn about fundamental physics. So we can start to constrain fundamental physics, like the standard model Lagrangian and the phenomenology of possibly something like, string theory very early on in the universe. And the two things that I'll focus on in this talk is the effort to measure the neutrino mass and how that fits into this broader picture of constraining beyond standard model physics, and looking for or ruling out signatures of cosmic inflation, right? And the way we'll do this is to map out the dark matter structure in the universe using the CMB as a backlight, and also this new technique of mapping out the velocity structures in the universe, also using the CMB as a backlight, but in conjunction with optical galaxy surveys. Now, the kind of stage here is that the universe is 13.8 billion years old, there's this radiation from when the universe became transparent after the universe expanded and hydrogen atoms formed. And so that radiation, called the cosmic microwave background, is primarily a snapshot of the fluctuations when the radiation of the radiation density when the universe is around 380,000 years old. But to see that CMB, because of the fact that light takes a finite amount of time to travel, we look through all the structure that's kind of newer, nearer, and we see it in the optical, the galaxies that trace the large scale structure in the universe. We look through that structure in order to see the CMB, which is the oldest, farthest light that we can see. We see that light in the microwave. And the prototypical surveys that we'll be using in the next 5 to 10 years to really perform this, the kind of analysis where you're looking at signals that are buried in the CMB that are correlated with the galaxies that are measured, will be surveys like the Rubin Observatory, the LSST survey of the Rubin Observatory that's going to be starting in a couple of years. And the CMB measurements will come from experiments like Simons Observatory in the next 5 to 10 years. Now, when you just look at that background, the CMB, the primary signal that we see here, I'm showing here as a projection of the entire sky in microwave light that's seen by the Planck satellite experiment. At first what we see is a uniform background that's around 3 Kelvin in temperature, but with tiny fluctuations of the 10 to the minus 5 level, 1 in 10 to the 5 fluctuations that have been measured at really high precision. And we've learned a great deal of things from looking at this primary fluctuations of the radiation density that measures what the universe looked like at 380,000 years. So we've learned what the age and expansion rate of the universe is. We've learned that it's dark matter dominated, but that the universe is accelerating, the expansion of the universe is accelerating. And the initial conditions of the universe are extremely simple, to the degree that we can constrain it so far, which is mostly Gaussian with nearly scale invariant initial conditions. Now, despite that broad picture that we've learned, there's a great deal of things that we still don't know about the universe. So that, the general program of cosmology here is to understand why the expansion of the universe is accelerating, to understand why dark matter exists. What is the particle nature of the dark matter that we see mostly through its gravitational influence right now? Whether there are additional light particles, and something I'll be focusing on, which is the question of the masses of neutrinos, as well as the initial conditions of the universe and various other questions. And the reason I'm putting these specific questions here is because the current generation, next generation CMB experiments are going to be weighing in on all of these questions. And the ones that I want to focus on really in this talk are the ones that are really tied to fundamental physics, which is this idea of really constraining the Lagrangian of the universe beyond what the standard model has already set up. As we see, now that we know that neutrinos should have mass, this is it necessitates going beyond the standard model Lagrangian that's been most recently with the Higgs boson, recent picture has been set up, the discovery of the Higgs boson. But also, as I'll get to in the second part of this talk, getting at the initial conditions through signatures buried in the CMB, again, using the CMB as a backlight, we can potentially constrain things like the phenomenology of string theory very early on in the universe, if that's the underlying theory of nature. So the new, at least in the last 5 years or so, we really started to go beyond looking at just the primordial fluctuations of the universe, and it's the interactions of the CMB as a backlight with matter as it evolves. So you can think of the CMB as being a spectator as the universe evolves, but then it occasionally interacts. The CMB light that's traveling as the universe expands and evolves from left to right here will occasionally interact with the matter, with the structure that forms. And most of my work has been focused on kind of isolate those small signatures that are buried underneath the primordial fluctuations. And what that allows you to do, if you can cross-correlate these signals with things that happen later in the universe, is to uncover new things and learn new things about the universe, like neutrino mass and dark energy. Let's first talk about this first goal of trying to measure the sum of neutrino masses through these interactions of the CMB with the underlying large scale structure that evolves later in the universe. So that's the first science example here. So the reason neutrino physics is kind of like really interesting to me in particular is that if you try to write down just the standard model of particle physics, then it's kind of surprising that neutrinos should have mass. But we know now that neutrinos should have mass because we've seen through solar and atmospheric and reactor neutrino oscillation experiments, the different flavors of neutrinos, the electron, muon, and tau neutrinos, can oscillate into each other. And the way this happens is that their underlying mass eigenstates, that the flavor states that we detect with our detectors, are superpositions of, are quantum superpositions of the underlying mass eigenstates. So when you detect something, there's a probability that one will go into another. That can only happen if there's a non-zero mass for the neutrinos. So this is really tied to physics beyond the standard model because this, any sensible way that you try to add mass will require extensions. And you'll see this in particular. The first thing we don't know is that while we know that the different mass eigenstates should have differences in their masses because of the fact that we observe the solar and atmospheric neutrino oscillations. So what those experiments measure, what those laboratory experiments that measure and astrophysical measurements measure, is the difference of the mass eigenstates. It's the difference of the mass squared. And what they don't tell you is what the absolute mass scale is. What is the total sum of all the neutrino masses of the three different mass eigenstates? And given the constraints we see from these atmospheric and solar neutrino oscillation experiments, you can arrange the neutrinos in two ways. You can have two mass eigenstates that are much lower than the third one, or two that are much more massive than the third one. And these two different hierarchies give you, again, given the constraints that we see from solar and atmospheric neutrino oscillation experiments, they give you a minimal mass. The total mass of the neutrinos has to be at least 60 milliarctan volts for the normal hierarchy. And for the inverted hierarchy, they have to be at least greater than 100 milliarctan volts. So what we don't know from particle physics experiments right now is what the total mass is and what the hierarchy or ordering of these mass states is. And in terms of, again, tying to these extensions beyond the standard model, neutrinos are the lightest massive particles that we know of. They're 6 to 10 orders of magnitude lighter than all the other standard model particles. And I think it's interesting to look for explanations of why that might be the case. And in particular, if you want to incorporate neutrino mass into the standard model, then you have to start adding new particles, in particular right-handed neutrinos, which we haven't seen evidence for so far. Those are generically required in order to generate mass for the ordinary neutrinos. So this ties into questions like whether there are additional sterile neutrino species, and the favored mechanisms, theoretical mechanisms behind generating these masses of neutrinos naturally also tend to explain why the active neutrinos are much lower mass than all the other particles. Now, the important thing here is that if you try to measure this kind of directly by, for example, looking at the decay of beta decay of tritium, then a direct experiment like Catrin will constrain the sum of neutrino masses to the level of around 200 milliarctan volts. So a direct measurement would do that to something like 200 milliarctan volts. Not quite at the level where you can actually start to detect the masses of the neutrinos in the minimum scenario yet. But the interesting thing is that current cosmological measurements are already constraining the neutrino mass to better than this level. And as I'll show in a bit, future cosmological measurements, the projected one sigma uncertainties at the 10 to 30 milliarctan volt level, which means we'll essentially be able to get a number for what the absolute mass scale is in the next 5 to 10 years. And that really is one of the ways in which cosmological measurements are really constraining this Lagrangian of the universe beyond the standard model physics. So how do we measure sum of neutrino masses with cosmology, right? So that's the next part here. The basic idea is that the evolution of structure in the universe, the cosmic structure, which is mostly dark matter, so 80% of its matter is dark matter, the density of that cosmological structure is smoothed by the presence of massive neutrinos. So I'm showing here three different slices of different kinds of cosmological simulations, where the ones on the left here have massless neutrinos, and the ones on the right here have higher mass neutrinos. And the more massive neutrinos are, the more they tend to behave like warm dark matter, that they have large free streaming velocities, and they smooth out structure on really small scales relative to large scales. So on very large scales, they behave like cold dark matter. On small scales, they behave like warm dark matter. So the more mass you have, the more you smooth out the structure on small scales. So the essential picture here is we need some way of measuring the cosmic density of by looking at the sky, by mapping out structures. And then we compare that to our expectations based on theoretical predictions when you have different amounts of neutrino mass. And depending on the amount of smoothness in the cosmic density field, you can map that onto a number for the sum of neutrino masses. The problem with trying to do this, though, especially with galaxy surveys, and I'll just note here that the structure that you're seeing here is the cosmic web. The knots in this structure are galaxy clusters that contain hundreds to thousands of galaxies. So that's about a megaparsec wide. The challenge here is that you don't directly see these structures. Most of these structures are dominated by dark matter, so that's 80% of the total matter. What you see is the light from the galaxies, and the galaxies tend to form in the peaks of the dark matter. So if you just look at the galactic the distribution of galaxies, then you don't really measure the actual smoothness of the total matter distribution.
Can I ask a stupid question, Matt?
Sure.
In that previous slide, my intuition is what your words say, is that relativistic things would smooth things out, and the picture on the right looks like it's smoother than the picture on the left, whereas it's been labeled as being the high mass one. Is that right?
That's right. So the key thing here is the relative difference. So it's a relative difference between small scales and large scales. So if you have massless neutrinos, then they behave just like radiation everywhere. Right. So that's an extra point that I didn't explain.
I see.
Completely massless neutrinos and the relative structure, the smoothness on the large and small scales would be the same. And so they just behave like radiation. So I've cheated a bit by showing here simulations actually of warm dark matter, but in reality, what you want is adding a small amount of massive neutrinos, and it's the difference between the small scales and the large scales. On the large scales, they behave like cold dark matter. That's a good question. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Great. So that's the problem. So a big part of this problem is that 80% of the matter is invisible. It's dark matter. But then even a bigger problem here is that the effect, like while I'm showing here like highly exaggerated simulations, the effect of the massive neutrinos on the total matter distribution, even if you could see the total matter distribution, and the effect on the massive neutrinos, it's effect of the massive neutrinos on the cosmic structure is already at the few percent level. So you're trying to look for a few percent smoothness, relative smoothness between small scales and large scales, most of the matter is invisible to begin with, right? So that's the key the key problem here. So the question is, how do we measure that underlying total matter distribution that's dominated by the dark matter? And my favorite way of doing that is to use gravitational lensing of the microwave sky. So the idea here is that, as I mentioned, the CMB is mostly this, a picture of the primordial fluctuations, or at least the primordial fluctuations as they were at when the universe was 380,000 years old. But as it travels through the universe, it interacts through through gravitational deflections as space-time is bent by the massive structures. So the photons get deflected, and that leads to a subtle change in the distribution, the statistics of the CMB itself. And the reason I like this in particular, compared to things like using the shapes of galaxies, the shape distortions of galaxies, is that is mostly sensitive to structure that's at slightly earlier times in optical galaxy surveys, during which the universe is mostly linear. And so the modeling here, the theoretical predictions that you can make for the CMB lensing signal are extremely robust. But like any measurement using gravitational lensing, the key thing here is that you're measuring the total matter distribution. So you're able to find a way to kind of see the dark matter, not directly through any electromagnetic interaction, which it might just not have, but through its gravitational influence, you're able to map out that total matter that's dominated by the dark matter. And to give you a picture of what this looks like in terms of CMB data analysis, like if you zoomed into a portion of the sky and you looked at the unlensed CMB, and then you flipped between the lensed CMB, the unlensed CMB, you'll see that the effect is extremely subtle. So now we have an additional challenge. Not only is the effect of the massive neutrinos on the cosmic structure a few percent level, and most of the dark matter is dark, but also the effect of lensing on the CMB itself is really subtle. This is why we really need lots of data to measure this accurately, to get to the point where we can constrain these with interesting constraints. So this subtle change to the CMB, you can think of it as, if I'm a plot in front of it in grayscale with some transparency, the dark matter, the projected dark matter structures that are causing the gravitational lensing of the CMB, then these structures tend to have degree, they tend to be largest on degree scales. And what they cause is small scale deflections. You can see that there's the CMB photons get moved by arc minute scales, by tiny scales on the sky, but that those deflections are coherent over the degree scales that are the size of the dark matter lenses. And in terms of estimators, what this essentially translates into is that if you were to take a Fourier transform of the 2D CMB image, then previously the CMB is like a statistically isotropic field, which means that the different modes, Fourier modes, are independent. But once you add in gravitational lensing, unequal Fourier modes of the CMB have a non-zero coupling, that is proportional to the lensing, gravitational lensing potential, phi here. So that's the basic idea here. So take the observed CMB, which you see in the microwave light, and you need high resolution measurements so that you're able to distinguish between these small scale deflections. And then using the underlying fact that this introduces the statistical anisotropy in the CMB, it couples the different modes of the CMB together in a way that's proportional to the underlying gravitational potential of the dark matter distribution. You can now go from a map of the observed CMB to a map of the dark matter distribution, right? So this is an idea that's been around for a while, maybe 20, 25 years from papers by Wayne Hu and several others. But over the years, there's been many different subtleties and techniques and novel applications of this technique of CMB lensing that I've had the pleasure of working on. But the thing that I want to keep, want you to keep in mind for the next 10 minutes is this idea that to go from this observed CMB light to the observed dark matter distribution using this coupling of the Fourier modes, what you really need, to get the distribution of those large scale lenses, you need to look at how the small scale CMB features change. And this is why we need higher resolution CMB experiments. So to recap, massive neutrinos smooth the matter distribution, and we need high resolution measurements of the microwave sky to map that matter distribution. So how do we measure the high resolution microwave sky? So we've seen pictures of the CMB on the full sky from the Planck satellite experiment. For the purpose of this talk, that's actually kind of low resolution, right? What we need is to go much beyond that. And so that's where the Atacama Cosmology Telescope is one of several telescopes that are on the ground. And so you can build a large telescope with a high resolution. And we're currently observing, so this collaboration consists of many people from many different universities, where our ongoing observations are measuring the CMB at a noise level that's 3 to 6 times lower than Planck, at a much higher resolution than Planck. Over 30% of the sky that's usable for science, right? For comparison, Planck measured something like 60% of the sky from space. And to just see visually what kind of improvement you get here, if I take a part of the sky that's measured by Planck, and I switch to the ACT plus Planck measurement, then you see that you get a much sharper image of the CMB sky, and you also enable a whole bunch of science. Including like looking for quasars, point sources, transients. We recently had a paper that looked at constraining the presence of Planet 9 by looking at potential microwave emission from a potential additional planet in the solar system. So there's a whole bunch of things that are enabled by higher resolution science. You can find galaxy clusters. So this sub-moon scale resolution is really what we kind of need to get to measuring gravitational lensing in particular. And if you want to measure gravitational lensing, you don't want to see these foregrounds. You want to avoid these foregrounds. And that's been a focus of my work has been to make these methods of estimating the lensing reconstruction robust against the presence of foregrounds. Okay, great. So ACT gives us these higher resolution measurements of the CMB data that's great for lensing. And so let me show you a new result from last year that kind of shows you really how, what the power of this technique is, at least in a small part of the sky. As I mentioned, you take the observed CMB light, you measure high resolution, and then you go from that to a map of the dark matter distribution. And so this is a zoomed in map of the gravitational potential that's measured using the ACT microwave data through gravitational lensing. It's an analysis that was led by a student at Cambridge, Omar Darwish, whom I advised for this project, which applied a new technique to avoid contamination from astrophysical foregrounds that I developed. So what you're seeing here in this picture are the bright spots here. This is an actual map using data. The bright spots are the peaks in the total matter distribution. I'm just going to call it the dark matter distribution because that's what dominates it. So the peaks of the dark matter distribution, and then the valleys here are the voids in the projected line of sight dark matter distribution. Now that on its own might not look very interesting because it just looks like noise. But what we did is to plot on top of that contours that show the distribution of galaxies. Okay, so measured using Planck completely independently. So now you're looking at what the correspondence between galaxies made of baryons, right? So ordinary matter, stars, etc. And so that's a distribution that's measured by a separate experiment. And I'm plotting that on top of this dark matter map that we made. And you can see that, you know, now you can see that it's not really just noise. What you're seeing here is a really starting to make a high fidelity map of the dark matter by using the gravitational lensing of the CMB. And you can see that the red galaxy peaks really align well with the dark matter peaks, and the blue galaxy voids align with the dark matter voids. Are there any questions so far on that? Okay, so so we went a step further here, and then we took a sample of galaxies from the Sloan survey, so the SDSS survey. So the spectroscopically detected galaxies, we've looked at their positions on the sky, and then we looked for the cross correlations. So we tried to like quantify this statistically. So with a different sample of galaxies where we know their distances pretty well. So how well is the dark matter correlated with the galactic, with the distribution of galaxies? And you can plot that as a function of scale. So the correlation strength is as a function of fluctuation scale. So if you go to the right on the x-axis here, you're looking at small scales, and on degree scales here on the left here. And you can compare that with a theoretical expectation of what the lambda CDM, the standard model of cosmology, would tell you, and we find great agreement. And the new thing, one of the new things here is that, as I mentioned, if you try to do this with high resolution data, because of the fact that it is high resolution, you're seeing not just the cosmic microwave background, but also these additional astrophysical foregrounds. And so we really needed to like work hard here to make sure that we're not contaminated by these foregrounds when we're making these kind of measurements. So this is an important step, like looking at the smoothness, the amount of fluctuations in the total matter distribution as a function of scale is precisely what we need to do to translate this into a measurement of the sum of neutrino masses. So we'll just remind you again, so that you're looking for this cosmic density that's smoothed by mass of neutrinos. And this is the kind of measurement that tells you how smooth is the dark matter distribution. Right now, we're just not at the level where we can constrain that very well. So we're just looking for consistency with a standard model that constrains some amount of neutrino mass. But to look at, again, to quantify what I said earlier, the scale-dependent change, the small scales are suppressed more by the presence of massive neutrinos relative to the large scales where they behave like cold dark matter. So you want to ask the question again quantitatively, how much lensing is there as a function of scale? And then that translates to a measurement of neutrino mass. So to get to the level where we can really kind of constrain neutrino mass at the 100 millielectron volt level or better to really detect that signal for the first time, what we need is more data. And so while I showed you a map that was on a small part of the sky, a zoomed in part of the sky with high fidelity reconstruction of dark matter, with data up to 2019 from the ACT telescope, now we cover 30% of the sky. And so this is a preliminary map that we were currently working on right now, is going beyond just that small patch of the sky that I showed, but to really map out the dark matter on all of the sky that's accessible to us from the ground in the Atacama Desert in Chile. And this preliminary map here, which we're still in the process of validating, it shows you that now you're seeing these fluctuations, again, really well correlated with the cosmic infrared background, the distribution of dusty star-forming galaxies. So that's just like a plot that we try to make sure that we are seeing something that's not noise. And the exciting thing here is that with this kind of map, we're already at the level where we can constrain the neutrino mass to a 1 sigma uncertainty of 60 millielectron volts. That's close to ruling out the inverted hierarchy of neutrinos, which says that neutrinos should be, the sum of neutrino mass should be greater than 100 millielectron volts. Right, so with this new data set, we are entering into this point where we're starting to constrain particle physics. And for those of you who might be following anomalies in cosmology somewhat closely, there is this, just looking at the kind of a model independent, the amplitude of fluctuations in the universe, we're going to be measuring this at a level that's four times better than Planck has already done. But four times better than what the Planck satellite has already done. That's kind of interesting because there are these tensions anomalies at the 2 to 3 sigma level that say that if you try to extrapolate what the amplitude of fluctuation should be from what the CMB, primary CMB measurements tell you, then it gives you a slightly different answer from what galaxy surveys actually find. So beyond just constraining neutrino mass and various other, you know, extensions of the standard model of cosmology, we'll also just be looking at like some model independent consistency checks between different probes in the universe. And so we've worked hard and we're currently working hard to make sure that we're making this measurement in a way that's that it's a robust against the way we simulate things like our noise and the way the presence of astrophysical foregrounds, as I mentioned earlier. Right. Okay. So that's the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, which is going to be looking at providing data in the next. So we hope to have this data released in the next year. But looking a little bit further ahead, in 2023, so there's currently under construction, we have the Simons Observatory, which is a telescope with a similar resolution as ACT, but a lot more detectors. So we'll be measuring the CMB sky at 2 to 3 times lower noise level than ACT, 40% of the sky over multiple frequency channels to really get our ability to separate foregrounds to a much better level. My roles in this experiment are leading this group that reconstructs the gravitational lensing signal from the Simons Observatory. So really applying these techniques and using it on really high fidelity data that we'll have from the Simons Observatory. Among other things. And looking a bit further ahead in terms of the next 5 to 10 years, the mid-2020s are when this Simons Observatory will be going on the sky, but eventually there are plans and discussions of combining telescopes that are in the South Pole with telescopes that are in the Atacama Desert to do a joint CMB stage 4 effort, which will push this even further. So you'll see CMB stage 4 forecasts coming up a little bit up ahead. And the timeline here is that, as I said, you know, we're hoping to have the next set of ACT results that constrain the neutrino mass to the 60 millielectron volt level in the next year or so. And the final set of science results that use all the data up to 2021 in a couple of years. And then potentially first science results from Simons Observatory from 2025 onwards. So what does a measurement of the gravitational lensing signal look like for Simons Observatory? So this is a forecast that shows, again, this plot of how much lensing there is as a function of scale. Now we're talking about, you know, so I mentioned that the neutrino mass signal is a percent level effect on the smoothness of the cosmic density field. But with the Simons Observatory, we're making a sub-percent measurement of that smoothness of the cosmic density field. That's what we're looking at here. How much lensing is a function of scale, and this is unprecedented, territory. So there's like a number of projects that we'll be looking into in the future, including understanding and mitigating the impact of instrumental effects and making sure that our foreground mitigation techniques are under control. And in terms of how that translates to an actual measurement of neutrino mass. I think, you know, given the caveat that all of this is under the, with cosmology, you're always making inferences under a certain model, right? And so when people talk about the Hubble tension and all that, since this is a caveat, is that any statements that you make is under some model. So under a standard model of cosmology that's not too weird, you can forecast that we'll be able to exclude the inverted hierarchy with the Simons Observatory. And with something like CMB stage 4, we'll possibly detect even the minimal mass of neutrinos. That's the constraint here on the y-axis here. And the reason I'm putting forward that caveat is that this is not a replacement for direct particle physics experiments that try to measure, you know, like Catrin that try to measure from the lab. It's complementary. In particular, you can imagine scenarios like CMB experiments not being able to measure constraining the neutrino mass to be really small, but a direct detection experiment measuring something to be much larger, in which case there could be weirdness in the model, including things like neutrino decay or something like that, right? So this complementarity with particle physics is a key part of this effort. So I'll stop for questions before the next part, and I'll just recap while people chime in if they have questions. So the recap is the neutrinos smooth this cosmic matter distribution, and we can measure the matter distribution from the microwave sky using gravitational lensing. And the next part of my talk is to switch gears to another topic, which is that we can learn about the very early universe, not just the neutrino mass, where the neutrinos become non-relativistic later on in the universe because they have mass, but also about the extremely early universe, the period close to cosmic inflation when that it's close to the initial conditions of the universe.
So can I ask a question, Matt?
Yeah.
So I don't know if you discussed this at any point. So there is, of course, the question of, baryonic physics and how much that could be confused. And I do wonder, how conservative these are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been a nice set of papers from Perimeter, actually. So including Fiona McCarthy, a student here, looking at the effect of baryonic effects on measuring neutrino mass, and also from Simon Forman, who might be on the call. The short answer to summarize that is the effect of baryonic feedback, I think, compared to, for others on the call who might not be familiar, the distribution of the dark matter, the total matter distribution, some of it is also the baryons. And so we don't really understand baryonic processes, like astrophysical processes, on small scales all that well. And in particular, they might have the potential to have feedback on the dark matter distribution itself. For example, active galactic nuclei can throw stuff out and change the structure on small scales. The nice thing about CMB lensing is that we're mostly probing very large scales. And most of the information is really coming from the amplitude of this on somewhat large scales. And if you look at it quantitatively, even in the most extreme models of baryonic feedback, the bias on neutrino mass is like, Simon, if he's on, can correct me if I'm wrong, but like, you know, at the level of like 10% to 30% of the neutrino mass itself, and it only kind of bumps it up a little bit. And that's in the most extreme models of baryonic feedback. And this is to be compared with something like galaxy lensing or galaxy clustering and all these measurements that tend to probe lower redshifts, later times in the universe, and the effects of baryonic feedback are much more important. And so that's something that's, I think, still an open issue in non-CMB lensing ways of trying to measure. Did I answer your question, Yash? Is that?
Yeah. No, that's exactly what it is. So you're saying basically CMB lensing is a much cleaner measurement because it's much less sensitive to baryonic feedback, and we probably basically won't have to worry about it for the next 10 years at least or so.
I think so. Unless the baryonic feedback effects are super extreme, in which case there's still ways to mitigate it by, this is an entire other talk that I can give this. You know, they can marginalize over models of baryonic feedback, but also mm-hmm. you can combine the measurements of the kinetic SE effect, which is what I'm going to talk about next, which measures the baryons, and then you can do a joint modeling of the baryons and the dark matter signal.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
I guess a related question, if I can ask briefly, apart from the fact that the CMB is deeper, on what is there a crossover scale where on some smaller scale, you know, Euclid lensing is better, and on maybe on larger scales, CMB lensing is better? The CMB people tend to plot like the CLs of the potentials, and other people plot the CLs of the kappa. So I'm trying to visualize in my head where they would cross over if they do, but it's not coming to me right now.
That's a good question. So I think, you know, future galaxy lensing surveys also measure signal dominated modes out to maybe LF of, multiples of a few hundred. I think in terms of raw statistical power, CMB lensing is probably not the best. I'll admit that, right? If you have a really good galaxy survey, it's a good question. I don't remember quantifying the actual statistical uncertainty on this. In terms of raw statistics, overall signal to noise of measuring lensing, something like Euclid or LSST might be much better, but the systematics, it's much cleaner with CMB lensing. I think you can be very confident with the measurement you make here.
Thanks.
Okay.
Ben, Yeah. Sorry, maybe just to comment on this question about baryonic effects for neutrino mass. I think it's only slightly worse than you say. So in the most extreme case we found, it seems like you can get a bias on the total neutrino mass, which is tens of percents of the value, maybe up to 30%, which could be of the same order as the statistical uncertainty for CMBS4, say. But these papers by Fiona have shown that there are a few different methods you can use to try and mitigate that without much sacrifice to statistical uncertainty. So it is something you need to pay attention to, but it probably won't be a problem if you handle it properly in terms of precision.
That's right. And I think, you know, there's still some unexplored territory here in terms of like combining with direct measurements of the baryon distribution from KSC, which I'll talk about next in a bit. But, you know, that's like, even if the model's really extreme, I think joint measurements will solve the problem in the next 5 to 10 years. Okay, so in the next 20 minutes, I want to switch to this kind of new technique that came from work that I did with many folks here at Perimeter. And so this is the science that we're trying to get at here is now a little bit different. We're not looking at the standard model Lagrangian directly, like, you know, looking at extending it for neutrino mass, but instead asking the question, is there interesting new phenomenology in the very early universe that we can explore? And the theory, the prototypical theory that I'll be taking here is inflation, right? So inflation is this period of exponential expansion very early on in the universe. It's driven by the energy density of one or many scalar fields. So, like if you have a scalar field and it has a non-zero vacuum expectation value, then it's going to drive exponential expansion. And the reason historically why this is proposed is because it solves several problems, including the fact that we see a mostly smooth universe, that's so-called horizon problem, the fact that we don't really see any spatial curvature and we don't see any relics from the early universe like magnetic monopoles. So inflation is supposed to solve some of these problems kind of naturally. But most importantly, it generates the primordial fluctuations that seeded this cosmic web structure that eventually forms galaxies and dark matter structures. The seeds of that are laid by this inflationary, by the quantum fluctuations of the inflaton scalar field. So that's the broad motivation here for inflation. But what we're really coming to in the next decade with an experiment like Simons Observatory is probing that the phenomenology of inflation, potentially constraining it to the point where we might have to think about other possibilities other than inflation. You know, despite the fact that this is really successful at explaining the existence of primordial fluctuations, we haven't yet seen gravitational waves from this violent inflationary period in the early universe, which is somewhat kind of generically predicted, some would say. That's not what I'll be talking about. So this is one of the things that the Simons Observatory will be measuring really well, is to constrain gravitational waves through their effect on the polarization of the CMB really well. But for the next 20 minutes, I'll just talk about non-Gaussianity. As I mentioned, the initial conditions of the universe are extremely Gaussian, but there's ways you can arrange things in the early universe that generically predict non-Gaussianity. And the idea here is that, you know, again, this inflation is supposed to be driven by the energy density of one or many scalar fields. And once you have many scalar fields, which again, some theorists would say that this may be a generic prediction of things like string theory, where if you try to compactify the extra dimensions in string theory, then you end up with tens or hundreds of different fields, which are scalar fields whose energy density can drive this inflationary period. But what happens generically when you have multiple scalar fields is that you predict a certain amount of departure from Gaussianity. Now, this is something that was really exciting before the Planck satellite measurement measured the CMB really well, which gives you a kind of a picture of the an almost pristinely preserved picture of the level of Gaussianity or non-Gaussianity in the early universe. But non-Gaussianity is not quite dead yet. I think in terms of quantifying this, the way that you take the primordial potential and you add to that one kind of non-Gaussianity, local primordial non-Gaussianity, adds to that the square of the field. And so this entire field becomes non-Gaussian. this FNL parameter has been constrained down to the level of something like one sigma uncertainty of 5 by the Planck CNB experiment. But the level that's predicted generically when you have multiple scalar fields is something like 1, right? So FNL of less than 1, once you constrain FNL to the level of less than 1, then I think many of these multi-field inflation models are in trouble, right? So we haven't quite reached the point where we can say that we are really probing the phenomenology of multiple field inflation. So the problem though is that the information in the Planck primary CNB, which is mostly on large scales, has kind of been saturated. But this paper by Neil and others several years ago shows that there's an additional signal that gets buried in the way that galaxies cluster that captures this local primary Mongeau-Chanti effect, which is, to sum it up, there's a specific kind of excess clustering on very large scales of galaxies. When you look at biased traces, like fields at the peaks of the dark matter distribution, if you see excess clustering there, then that directly maps onto this FNL parameter. To show this kind of in pictures, let's say that you measured the distribution of lots of galaxies with something like the Rubin Observatory. So this legacy survey, a space and time survey of from the Rubin Observatory is going to measure the distribution of billions of galaxies. It's going to start up in a couple of years. And then you ask the question similar to what you did with lensing. You know, you're looking at the smoothness of that distribution. How much clustering is there as a function of scale on the sky? And in the absence of primordial Mongeau-Chanti, it looks, you know, has a certain shape. And you can, you know, if I can roughly just kind of like plot this a two-dimensional distribution of what the galaxies look like, then it has a certain shape. But if I have primordial Mongeau-Chanti, which causes couplings of large-scale modes with small-scale modes, when I look at the peaks of this galaxy, of the total matter distribution, which is where galaxies are, those peaks can get preferentially enhanced or suppressed if the FNL parameter is positive or negative. So one way you can constrain multi-field inflation is to look for excess clustering of galaxies on very large scales, right? The problem with this method is though is that even with a galaxy survey like the Rubin Observatory, LSST, there's a certain amount of noise and you have sample variance in these fluctuations. And what that means is that the constraint on FNL from just looking at the clustering of galaxies is going to be something like FNL of 2, which is not quite FNL of 1, which is what you'd need if you wanted to constrain multi-field inflation. So this is where, with several people here at Perimeter, including Kendrick and Matt and Moritz, who was a postdoc here, we looked at this question of whether we can improve these measurements of FNL beyond what galaxy surveys can measure. And it turns out you can do this by quite a bit using an additional backlight signature, which is the CMB imprint of moving clouds of electrons. So now we're talking not about the gravitational influence of these galaxy clusters in the universe, but instead the fact that they have ionized gas in them means that the CMB light is going to scatter off of these ionized clouds of gas. And because they have bulk motion, that imparts additional anisotropies, it boosts or suppresses the temperature of the CMB at the location of galaxy clusters that are moving. So the thermal SC effect is when you have thermal energy in these ionized gas clouds. But the kinetic SE is the additional anisotropy that you have because of the fact that these clouds of gas are moving. And this means that on the CMB sky, you're going to see additional anisotropies that probe the integrated line of sight product of the velocity field of the universe times the electron density in the universe. And this has currently been measured at the 4 to 8 sigma level. But when you start combining with new surveys like LSST, we're going to be really like the signal to noise here is going to explode. And to give you a visual picture of what this looks like, this is what the primordial CMB looks like. Maybe it has lensing in it. The fluctuations are at the level of 300 microkelvin. But buried underneath that at the few microkelvin level are these freckles, these like additional fluctuations where if you have a region where things are moving towards you, the regions of ionized gas in the universe look hotter on average. And if there's regions in the universe that are moving away from you, then they look colder than average. So there's information in these anisotropies that maps out the velocity structure in the universe, as well as together with the ionized gas distribution. To give you a cartoon picture of what measuring this actually might look like, let's say that you have a one-dimensional cosmic velocity mode. So things on the right side here are moving towards you, and things on the left side here are moving away from you. Then at the location of galaxies, which have ionized gas in them, you'll see a positive fluctuations, things hotter on average. So if you imagine just dividing the CMB temperature by the galaxy positions, and what you're really getting from that is a reconstruction of the cosmic velocity modes in the universe. And the reason this is interesting is because if you have a measurement of the cosmic velocity modes, then you're going to be able to use the continuity equation to transform that into a measurement of the matter distribution in the universe. And so going back to this question of like measuring the structure on very large scales, you can do that with galaxies, but if you transform a measurement of the cosmic velocity field into a measurement of the structure on large scales, then it turns out that you, with a combination of a CMB survey and a galaxy survey, you measure this at much lower noise. The noise per mode that you have on the large scales is much lower. And what that means is once you start combining CMB surveys and galaxy surveys using this velocity reconstruction technique that uses the KSE effect, we can now go from, we can now have factors of 2 to 3 improvement over what the galaxy survey on its own can do. So with the next set of data that's coming up, we can measure FNL to 10 and then eventually 5 at Simons Observatory. And eventually with CMB stage 4, we'll get to the level where FNL is measured at the less than 1 level. I'm noticing that my video is choppy. Can you still hear me fine?
For me, it's fine. I haven't noticed any choppiness.
Okay, I think it's just on my side here on my computer. Great. So that's really kind of the big picture here is that with these measurements of cosmic velocity field, we're talking about improving the measurements of FNL by factors of 1.5 to 3, but only once you combine these CMB backlight measurements with galaxy surveys. And I think that's really exciting because now we are talking about using yet another way to constrain fundamental physics. And possibly string theory phenomenology, or ruling it out, right? So ruling out multi-field inflation and ruling out the presence of multiple scalar fields will be really constraining for model builders. And so that's something we can do in the next 5 to 10 years. And that's something that it's a unique thing that's provided by the combination of CMB and galaxy surveys. Okay, so I'll just summarize here. There's a question from Ghazal.
Yeah, sorry, I just have to, I don't know, like this is just more on the philosophy of model building, but I'm not aware that non-Gaussian entities are generic feature of multifields. As far as I remember, they were the outcome of a particular models that were constructed to produce non-Gaussian entity like Kervaton. But I don't know if there's a deeper argument that all multifields, that's what my little collection is, like mostly these particular models, which people thought, I mean, it's important to measure FNL, obviously, on those scale. But anyway, I don't think it's generic for multifields. It's just those kind of model that can produce it, they do it, but maybe I'm wrong.
Thanks. Yeah. So I might be overstating how generic it is, but I think if you agree that it's interesting to measure it because it constrains those models that do predict it, then yeah, that's really the main message. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, but it's fair to say that a non-zero detection would exclude single field, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, I agree. So that's different. I think my view is non-zero detection is more important than zero detection.
Okay, yeah, that's a fair point.
Matt, I also have a question. So can you go to the previous slide with the plot of FNL?
Yes.
Yeah, this one. So yeah, you have really like dramatic reduction of noise. So I wonder why the improvement of FNL is only a factor of a few and not really, I don't know, factor of 10 right away or 100.
Yeah, so it's a little bit deceptive because of the fact that this, you know, it's not really the noise. It's the thing that limits you here is the sample variance in this, right? So you can already see that the noise per mode is like lower than the fluctuations in the Galaxy Plus signal itself. So there's a bit of an extra story here, which is sample variance cancellation. That's what, you know, Neil and others showed, that the, once you have an alternative way of measuring the underlying matter distribution, then you can cancel a lot of that sample variance, with the alternative measurement. And that's why it doesn't look as dramatic as the cosmic velocity noise reduction here looks. It's just that you reduce the amount of sample variance by having a highly correlated measurement.
I see. So your method doesn't reduce the sample noise per se. So you need several different bias tracers still.
That's right. You need two tracers. I mean, so you need another tracer. And so what you're doing here is measuring the underlying matter distribution by going from the using the continuity equation to take the velocity distribution, turn it into matter distribution, and that reduces the sample variance. And so that's.
I see. Okay. Thanks.
But following up on that, couldn't you just take two different types of galaxies and do this instead of using velocities?
That's right. So you could, as others, Kendrick and others have shown, like you can also do this with multiple bias tracers. Mm-hmm. I think in our paper, we have forecasted compare against that as well. You can always improve once you add cosmic velocity. Like even in the case where you have multiple tracers, your FNL constraint is even further improved. And then it's the additional fact that if you want to do multiple traces, then you need to do mass binning, which means you need to have like good measurements of the mass of the structure. But you know, even with like a single tracer, these are constraints of the single tracer that I'm showing here. You can improve by a factor of 3.
I see. So you think even if you use multiple tracers from galaxies, then this is still improves on that significantly.
That's right.
Okay. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
And may I ask one more question? So what are the prospect for spherics? Your method, to what extent does it applies to spherics?
That's a great question because it's been on my to-do list to actually do that forecast. The spherics, the forecasts are that it will constrain just with the distribution of spectroscopic galaxies or, you know, low resolution spectroscopy, that'll constrain FNL to less than 1. It's one of their primary science goals. I think, as I mentioned, like whatever a galaxy survey can do on its own, you can do better if you add in the sample variance cancellation from CMB, right? So yes, so SphereX is actually one of the more exciting experiments for this effect. Well, on its own, it can already constrain sigma FNL to less than 1. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do the forecast where we add KSC measurement to it, which even allowed us to do it even further. And this is assuming that spheres can measure the largest, the auto spectrum of the galaxies on the largest scales really well. Whereas, you can get an alternative measurement that doesn't use the auto spectrum of galaxies using just the, for example, because it might be contaminated by galactic extinction. But you don't have that worry here for the KSC part of the KSC measurement. So there's also questions of doing a complementary measurement that has different systematics, right? So if you were to combine with SphereX.
I see. Thanks. Yeah.
Wait, sorry. Matt, sorry. Just to follow up on what you just said. So you're saying that if you use KSZ and galaxies, you might be less sensitive to systematics that are present in only the galaxies. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. So I think in the original paper we showed, like we looked at a quick forecast, which seemed to suggest that you didn't actually need the auto spectrum part to be measured. You could marginalize over it, the galaxy auto spectrum, and you still get a similar constraint on FNL. I think that statement, we want to check that with simulations. But even if you didn't, even if you just excluded the galaxy auto spectrum part, which has the systematics, just using the auto spectrum of the velocity and the cross correlation of the galaxies to the velocities, you can get a slightly worse measurement of FNL, which is not affected by the systematics on large scales that galaxies will have. You agree with that, right?
Hmm.
right? So I mean, that's, I think it's a huge worry for like all these experiments, like anything that tries to measure clustering on very large scales, is that it just might be contaminated with stuff from our own galaxy. And I think it's nice to have this independent measurement that might be slightly worse, but doesn't have those systematics.
Okay, like, so you're saying that most of this signal is in the velocity galaxy cross correlation and the velocity auto, and the galaxy auto, you're saying, isn't like, you know, well, it isn't contributing a lot to the signal.
Yeah, so that was what we saw with the Fisher forecast, just because of the fact that the correlation coefficient is extremely high. But I think that's still something we need to double check with like full end-to-end simulations that to make sure that statement holds. Like I said, yeah, you might lose some constraining power if you do exclude it, and then you're still getting an alternative measurement, which might be at the FNL of like one level, right? Once you combine with something like SphereX. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay. So we're a bit past the hour. So let me just, just wrapping up here, conclusion. I think what I'm personally really excited about the next decade of cosmology is that there's all this information that's buried underneath the CMB that we haven't exploited yet, which is to use smaller fluctuations, but we use the CMB as a backlight. With gravitational lensing, we are going to be reaching sub-percent precision in the next 5 to 10 years, allowing us to understand massive neutrinos. It'll start to constrain the standard, the Lagrangian of beyond the standard model. And this new application of the CMB plus galaxy field, where you infer the cosmic velocity field, we can potentially detect or rule out a smoking gun signal qualified with Ghazal's statement that, you know, I think a detection would definitely be much more interesting and informative than rolling it out. But, that on its own, I think is very exciting. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thanks, Matt. That was wonderful. So let's all unmute to give Matt a round of applause. Okay, so we are like slightly over, but there's still time for questions. So if there are further questions, please feel free just to, unmute yourself and jump in.
So Matt, just a like general question. So are you also part of the gravitational wave working group in ACT or Simons Observatory?
I work with them quite a bit, yes. In particular for the parts where we are trying to coordinate the effect of instrumental systematics for gravitational wave measurements, that's something that I'm heavily involved with. I didn't get to talk about that, but I think it's really exciting, right? I mean, we're going to be constraining it several factors improvement over current constraints, potentially even an order of magnitude, I think, right? So it's the challenge there is really just like measuring the large scale modes of the CMB polarization. So I think there's going to be a lot of the uncertainty is really around what the effect of things like ground contamination are, which you don't have in things like space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. While we have you, can I ask about, what are the prospects for future and effective constraints? Okay. Well, we don't have to, but.
So looking at the number of light relativistic species, I think you get to something like a level of 0.03, you can start to like really look at deviations from standard thermal history. So currently the number of light relativistic species is like measured to something like 10% by Planck. But it should be improved by, I think, an order of magnitude, right? So that's another science goal here, which is like constrained fractional changes in the number of light relativistic species when you have non-standard thermal history in the universe from additional light particles. That's That's also something that you further improve when you have something like CNB stage four. I don't think I have a slide for that though. Mm-hmm.
I guess in light of Neil's question, may I ask a question that I'm interested in as well? So what is the current status of proving or disproving like the result of Komatsu?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the problem with that measurement, not the measurement itself, but the problem that's, you know, detection exists is that we in ACT independently have measured the the rotation of the polarization angle, and we don't detect it, right? So the unlike several other experiments, we've like gone through a large amount of effort to try and make sure that the instrumental systematics and the polarization rotation caused by this birefringent field, this axion field, is that the instrumental systematics is well under control. And so our measurement is like consistent with zero and tighter than the constraint that Komatsu et al. Finds. They do use a slightly different method, but they use more of the sky and then use the foregrounds to kind of self-calibrate instrumental systematics. Yeah. And we have efforts ongoing right now in ACT. And I think the exciting thing here is that we have lots of data that'll, if we use the same technique as they did, we should have a definitive answer, right? And so when I showed you these plots of the gravitational lensing maps that we're making, so this particular analysis, the reason why it's not out yet is because we are using data that including the polarization measured really well, that hasn't been fully validated yet. And once it's been fully validated in terms of passing null tests and all of those things, the I don't have a forecast for you, but I think it'll be very interesting in terms of like, you know, the constraint using a similar method as Komatsu's would be, it should definitely settle the question of whether what they saw is real or not, just using the data up to 2019.
Okay, I'll keep waiting. Thanks.
Matt, could I follow up on Sergei's question? Do you know there's this particular prediction which I'd be curious to see rolled in or out of the gravitational wave, the tensor to scalar ratio predicted by Higgs inflation? In other words, if the inflaton is just the standard model Higgs, mm-hmm. which is like R of 10 to the 3 times 10 to the minus 3. Do you know, is Simon's Observatory, would it be the first experiment to get there, or is it not quite, or would it reach that?
That level is what's probed by the Simons Observatory, but also by efforts at the South Pole together with BICEP. I can't make statements about, you know, who's going to get there first yet, but, you know, getting to that few times 10 to the minus 3 level is a big goal of Simons Observatory and possible extensions of Simons Observatory and definitely eventually CMB stage 4. I wasn't aware of that particular model, Latham, and I'd be happy to talk about it. But I think, you know, that's a great thing about this, right? You're constraining interesting levels of the gravitational waves.
Mm-hmm. You think a few times 10 to the minus 3 is roughly the 1 sigma error bar, you mean? Or you think that they would be able to rule that in or detect or rule out that level?
I'm forgetting exactly what it was, but it's definitely, close to, bit better than 10 to the minus 2. Certainly CMB stage 4 would be better than at the 10 to the minus 2 level. Uh-huh. Forgetting exactly what it was at the moment.
Okay, thanks.
Like we're 10 past the hour. So in view of the time, let's stop here. Thanks again, Matt, for a fantastic talk.
Thank you.